Thanks for joining A&M Conversation With, a podcast series featuring Alvarez and Marsal leaders discussing the trends impacting businesses today. In this episode of A&M Conversation With, Dr. David Gruber, a managing director with our healthcare industry group, sits down with Peter Urbanowitz, also a managing director with our healthcare industry group, and John Cox, a managing director with our public sector services, to discuss the aftermath of the canceled House healthcare bill vote. Does this put an end to repairing the ACA?
Thank you, Peter and John, for joining us today. Lots to speak about given the implosion of the American Healthcare Act last Friday. Peter, what's next? Is repeal and replace dead for now?
Well, to paraphrase the great writer Mark Twain, I think the reports of the death of repeal and replace are greatly exaggerated. Obviously, a huge setback on Friday. The votes weren't there to pass legislation out of the House. And the initial post commentary was, this is it. This was our try. And now we're going to put this on the back burner. And we're just going to let the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, play itself out. If there are problems, they'll play themselves out. And maybe people will come back next year and try to fix it. Obviously, a lot of soul searching after they pulling the bill on Friday. And you hear something different coming out now, a little muted, but still the idea that maybe something can get done. There's still a vehicle out there to do something if there is some way that Speaker Paul Ryan and President Trump can pull together a fractured Republican caucus. So I don't completely dismiss the possibility of there being some legislation emerging from the House in the next, maybe not the next couple of weeks, but maybe over the next couple of months. There's still a legislative vehicle out there to do it. Remember, they pulled the bill as opposed to vote on it. If they had voted on the bill and it got voted down, that would have put them in a real parliamentary quagmire of trying to resurrect something. But they still have a bill out there, a bill that can be amended, a bill that can be put back on the floor. As I said the last time, this is threading a needle for Speaker Ryan and President Trump. How do they get enough votes in the House with only Republicans, and how do they get enough votes with just Republicans in the Senate to make something happen? You know, it's premature, I think, to completely write it off and say nothing is going to happen. I still think there's a possibility of some legislative action in the next couple of months.
An executive order was signed by President Trump shortly after his inauguration. You know, what does that mean? What are its implications?
It actually was the very first executive order that President Trump signed in January, and essentially said two things. One is that it's his administration's position that the Affordable Care Act should be repealed and replaced. That's just a statement of policy. Without legislation, it doesn't get you anywhere. But what it does do is it reiterates the flexibility that the Secretary of HHS, Health and Human Service, the Secretary of the Treasury has in enforcing the Affordable Care Act. So with respect to the Secretary of Treasury, let's just go there. There's the individual mandate, and if you don't have insurance, you're supposed to pay a fine or penalty and report that on your income taxes and pay it at that time. The Treasury has put out a statement that said you can file your taxes this year, and you don't necessarily have to file a statement in there on whether or not you have insurance. So the IRS may or may not be taking action against individuals who don't have insurance and imposing the fine on them. So that's a big deal right there. That's a major change in the Affordable Care Act that they will just do by waiving a provision or deciding not to enforce it. On the HHS side, there's a number of things that Secretary Price can do to either not enforce parts of the Affordable Care Act or enforce the way or change the way that it will be enforced. Everyone thinks about the Affordable Care Act just in terms of the health insurance exchanges and the subsidies that go along with that. And there's certainly a lot of things that he can do on that. He can decide how much advertising is going to be out there on promoting the exchanges. He can decide what the government's position is going to be on providing subsidies. There are some legal challenges right now where the government can say, okay, we accept those legal challenges and we're not going to pay out certain subsidies. There's the whole Medicare part of the Affordable Care Act and demonstration projects like accountable care organizations and bundled payments where the secretary can have flexibility to say, well, I'm not going to let that go forward, or I'm going to let that go forward in a very different manner than it's been going forward. So that's the things that the executive order really plays up and suggests to both Secretary of HHS and Secretary of the Treasury and any of the other administration officials who have responsibilities on enforcing parts of the Affordable Care Act to say, you've got the flexibility to do what you want to do, so go do it.
So, John, are the states out of the woods yet? What are they thinking about at the moment? And how do you foresee the executive order affecting the states?
I think, first of all, David, thanks for having me today. But I think I would agree with Peter in the sense that there is definitely some regulatory flexibility that can be had. So first and foremost, states are thinking about a pause, just like they are in Congress, and trying to regroup, as Peter described. So I think states are sort of now sort of in a wait-and-see mode, number one. Number two, Secretary Price and CMS Administrator Verma issued a letter to state governors shortly after she was confirmed. And in that letter, they specifically talk about two things that are going to be of most interest to states, regardless of whether health care reform passed. Number one, they are signaling, quote, a new era for federal and state Medicaid partnership, unquote. That tells you and tells the reader that there's going to be not only a new sheriff in town, but also one that's going to be more amenable to listening to creative ideas. And they specifically mention that there are Medicaid innovations. They want to hear about those, and they'll be predisposed to support those and approve those. Number two, in the letter that they sent to governors, they talk about additional time to implement the home and community-based services rule. That is a major regulatory piece that was issued in January of 2014, with final rules set to be in place in 2019. The letter indicates that there's going to be some flexibility on the date, so they have more time to comply, states do. And secondly, they're going to be looking at that particular regulation, which is, again, a major federal regulation for state Medicaid offices. They're going to provide some additional flexibility to states in terms of assessing compliance with specific settings, which is what that rule is all about. So states still have a lot to comply with. They have a lot to worry about, and there's still a lot on their plate.
So, John, where do you think we go from here?
I think states are going to focus on the regulatory compliance issues. In addition to the HCBS final rule and also the managed care final rule, they're going to be very interested in that. They're also going to be looking at whether or not, with the letter that I referenced and specifically talking about 1115 compliance and being more flexible in that regard, I think what you might see is certain states looking at expanding their Medicaid population, the ones that haven't expanded already, using that 1115 authority. And the real reason is if they believe ultimately something will pass by expanding, they can improve their baseline of spending. And the net of that means they'll get more money in the event that a block grant or per capita ultimately is approved.
And Peter, final thoughts?
I think Speaker Ryan and the House leadership and President Trump learned about the dangers of arbitrary deadlines last week. The idea of having a Thursday vote and then a Friday vote was really a self-imposed deadline on House leadership. There's no reason that they couldn't have waited a week, a month, 2 months until they really felt that they had buy-in from everyone. And so I think what you're going to see is nobody's going to set a deadline. Nobody's going to say that there's going to be a vote, if there's going to be a vote on anything, next week or next month or this year on something, until I think they have a sense that they have a deal locked up on the House side. And in the meantime, I think what you're going to continue to see is on the administrative level, you're going to see them taking those actions that they can to, at least while the Affordable Care is out there, to have it enforced in a way which is likable or amenable to the political viewpoint, the policy viewpoint of this administration.
Thank you, Peter and John, and for those listening today. President Trump's tenure has been surprising, to say the least, so stay tuned for our thoughts on whatever emerges. I also want to emphasize that the Social Security Act expanding Medicare and Medicaid, the amendment was passed in 1965, and this is just one step in a far longer journey. So thank you.
For our listeners, for more information, visit our homepage at alvarezandmarsal.com and connect with us on LinkedIn at Alvarez and Marsal.